On this episode of African Retooled.
Until now, I still get people who don't believe I'm a journalist because they're like, no, you're a doctor, once a doctor, always a doctor. So what are you doing in the newsroom? So are you in practice? Where's your clinic? So I still get those questions because I think in an African society, I mean, if you're a doctor, why else would you change to anything else?
Do you have the tools to face the future? Welcome to African Retooled, a podcast where Chris and Martin, two African recruiters, will explore the changing world of work.
Where students come to learn and gain insights into the world of work, discover how they can continue to tool themselves with skills of the future. Where managers will explore with us how to confidently navigate the complexities of future work in order to be key disruption agents and remain competitive. Where CEOs, business owners come to understand the evolution of work, allowing them to leverage on emerging roles and remain competitive and achieve their objectives.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to yet another episode of African Retooled.
Hi there, Martin. How are you?
I'm very well. Chris, how has it been for you?
It has been quite interesting in this season. We continue to still see the need to have conversations with retooled Africans, people who have espoused the ethos of being a retooled African.
Indeed.
And so we continue to scout around for these people. And we found one such person, and extremely interesting, Martin.
I'm telling you, I can't wait to hear what she has to say.
Yeah, she happens to be a doctor. She's done a bachelor's degree in medicine and surgery. Mm-hmm. I mean, Martin, by the time you do medicine, that's a life commitment.
Yes, it is, truly.
So 7 years of your life, I think six in some cases. And guess this, and guess what, rather? Mm-hmm. She decides to change and go into journalism.
So she's moved from a medical science to a social science.
There you go. So she's,
talk of pivoting,
she's now done a Master of Arts in communication studies. And so this individual today is actually not practicing medicine, but has transitioned into being a journalist. So she's a medical journalist working with one of the largest media houses in Kenya, KTN. And she actually hosts a weekly TV health news feature show. So, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm really excited and looking forward to hearing her story and how she actually transitioned to these fields that are totally different, but I guess there's a story.
I'm telling you. Yeah. But, you know, without further ado, let's jump into it. Please, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show, Dr. Mercy Korea.
So welcome, Daktari. It is our pleasure, honestly.
Truly, it is our pleasure. Yeah,
to have you. It's been we've been talking for about, what, two weeks? And we're excited to finally have you in front of us. It's always really fascinating to meet individuals who have been able to do what you've done. And we look to celebrate them on this podcast. We are fascinated by your experience. I mean, the ability to go and study to be a doctor. This is something that we feel, Martin, I think takes people a lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to study.
It does.
And then to actually practice and then decide to make a total shift. And I like to say, I mean, when you think about it, Martin, a doctor is on the other scale when it comes to a profession. And then you look at a journalist on the other side, which is a social science. So it's very interesting. And we're curious to know, how did you even think about journalism as a career, and how did that transition actually happen?
That thought process, it just baffles us.
Yeah, so I get this question asked many times,
right?
But each time I never really have a direct answer. So I'll try and explain in the briefest time possible. So growing up, really, I wanted to be a doctor. I mean, it's from, you grow up and you're a bright kid, you're always the first in school. I remember in primary school, at the end of the term, there was an assembly, and then they call from class 1 to class 8. So they call number 3, 2, 1. Anytime they reached my class, they would call number 3, they'll call number 2, and then everyone would say in unison who number 1 was. So it so happened that I didn't know, but then I was just like doing my thing, that I happened to be a bright kid. And so everyone around me was like, you know, maybe you should become a doctor. But I was not really sure about, you know, what I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. I think for me, the earliest thoughts that I have about a career I would want to pursue was to be a pilot. Mm-hmm. And this was back in the village. I think I was herding cows or something out in the fields. Mm-hmm. I saw a plane up in the sky. And I thought, oh, that would be nice to be there, to do that. But that was just as much as it. But then going into primary school, when I was in class 8, my then head teacher brought me this book to read, Gifted Hands by Ben Carson. And I was fascinated. And I thought this guy was doing really interesting and amazing things as a neurosurgeon. And I was curious to know, you know, what he's doing, if I could do it, you know. And so I decided it would be an interesting thing to do, to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. And since anyway I had the grades back then, I thought it's something I could give a shot. Okay. And so that's how the path for me to being a doctor came. Mm-hmm. And so I worked my way and made it to the University of Nairobi. 5 years, did my medicine, and then went into internship. So mm-hmm. journalism was never really anywhere mm-hmm. on my journey. It was not on my scale. It's not like, you know, there are people when they grow up, they want to be like a certain anchor or presenter, journalist. No, for me, I wanted to be a doctor. But then, and I was just thinking about it before we started this, like I took literally the powers that you're given when you graduate, you know, like you've been given the power
to read.
Exactly. And do all that pertains to this degree. Yes. So after I worked in the public sector in Kenya, I worked in the private sector, and I could see that there was really big differences between the people who are accessing healthcare in the private sector and those who are accessing healthcare in the public sector. It was a lot to do with knowledge, with information. Mm-hmm. Some had information overload, some did not have any information. So for me, it seemed that there was a gap in there.
Okay.
And so back in high school, in medical school, I was always interested in writing. I was always interested in languages.
Mm-hmm.
So after I finished my internship, I thought maybe I could pursue communications mm-hmm. and see what I can do with it in the medical field. Mm-hmm. And that's how I landed into journalism. It was just like a trial and error. Let me see if it will make a difference. And I think for me, the calculations that I was doing in my mind was when I sit in a clinic, I will see about 40, 50 patients in a day. But if I'm on radio, if I'm on TV, if I write a piece, then it will reach hundreds of thousands or even millions of people, and it will have a bigger impact. It will send the message. And then coming from a doctor and being in a society where we respect this profession,
mm-hmm.
then I thought it would be authoritative enough to have an impact in society.
Yeah.
So initially it was trial and error, then it worked, and here I am. And like I was saying earlier, my journey in journalism has been defined by the crisis. So the crisis for me that launched me into this path was the 2016-2017 doctors' strike.
Right.
The strike that they did for 100 days. Mm-hmm. So it so happened that when they were starting the strike, I'd just finished my internship at KTN News, and I happened to be in the newsroom.
Mm.
So I happened to report on the strike, and that is how I landed and started this career.
Wow. It's really interesting. Okay. I mean, so just as we were preparing for this episode, I did see that there is indeed an intersection between healthcare and journalism field. And I'm just curious, so why do you feel that there's such a big role that a journalist must play or the media must play in facilitating or overseeing healthcare outcomes?
Before I come to the health, generally, media landscape has changed.
Mm.
We are more digital now than we were 5-10 years before. By the time you are seeing something on news, you probably read it on Twitter. You've seen it on Facebook. It has made its round on your WhatsApp groups. So for a journalist, the question then is, what value are you adding to society?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about who is the first to break the news.
Right.
But what are you telling us? What is the context? What is the why? What is the so what of that news item? Mm. And so that is where journalism in generally is right now, or where I would want to see it, and where we should take journalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for health particularly, and we've seen 2020, it's been about COVID-19.
Mm.
When you're talking about the economy, we are talking about COVID-19. When we are talking about poverty, people having been pushed more into poverty, we are talking about COVID-19. When we are talking about job losses, unemployment, we are talking about COVID-19. Yet, this was initially a health crisis.
A health crisis.
But it has become a whole of society crisis. So that tells you that health really plays a critical role in our everyday lives.
Mm.
It is not just about that I don't have a disease, I'm okay, but we've seen a virus that originated from Asia is wreaking havoc all across.
Mm.
So health is important. So where journalists come in is one, to have an in-depth knowledge or some more knowledge than your average person on the health sector, so that now you're able to adequately address the issues of the so what, why, what is the context around this, you know, so that we are able to add value to society.
Mm.
We're able to contribute to the conversations that are happening in society, because it's when these conversations happen that we are able to advance society from one level of ignorance to a level where people can make informed choices. And for me, how I see it, when you think about health, probably you are thinking about the doctor, the hospital, but if you look at it, it's everywhere. From your legislators and your parliamentarians, these are the people who make certain laws and acts. As a country, for example, Kenya, the reason why we don't have UHC is because our parliament hasn't been actively involved as much as I would want them to be.
Oh, for the sake of our audience, what is UHC?
Of universal health, health coverage.
Right.
Yeah, so where all of us, it's actually the slogan is health for all.
Right.
Leave no one behind, where we can access healthcare services without having to pay out of pocket, because it's already been paid for, and we pay that through our taxes.
Mm.
So I'm thinking, if our politics were such that the conversations around health were about me as a citizen who pays taxes,
right,
then we would have better health outcomes. And when a crisis like this comes in, we are at a better place. When you talk about the Constitution gives us the right to health, access to health, emergency care. But if you go to a hospital right now and it's an emergency, they'll still ask you for a deposit. But why is that?
Mm-hmm.
Because we haven't been able to do certain things that will enable us to have a better quality of life, because we don't need to pay out of pocket. So how I see it is that these conversations for me on health are not just about the disease or the absence of disease, but about all of these other things and all other social determinants of health.
Mm. You know, that you brought that up, there was the Abuja declaration where people were saying, you know, all these states are saying this fantastic thing of 15% of national spend should be on health. Is that a reality in today's Africa?
Well, yes and no. Mm-hmm. Yes, because we've seen countries like Rwanda that have been able to allocate 15% of their budget to health.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just about what does a country prioritize. If you look at our, I usually like comparing our security budget and our health budget. Our health budget is at about 5-6% as Kenya, but security budget is, I think, 3 times that or 4 times that.
Mm-hmm.
So you ask yourself, where are we prioritizing our needs as a country? So in terms of allocating 15%, for me, it is possible. But then the conversations have advanced, because the Abuja Declaration was in 2001.
Yeah.
The conversations have advanced to now more critical look at how to allocate healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in Kenya, we spend 30% of our health budget is out of pocket.
Mm.
So the thinking should then be, reduce this 30% and allocate the 30% so that now you're able to cover that, because now we have, I don't know if that makes sense. We have, out of a cake of 100% that goes into budget, if you have 100 shillings going into budget, into healthcare expenditure, 30% means I have gone to hospital and I've had to pay.
Yes. Yeah.
You get?
For 100 bob, I have to pay 30 bob.
I have to pay 30 bob. So the rest are paid for by donors or by insurance, all of those other. So then the thinking should be, how this 30%, what amount is it so that we fill that gap and we remove the citizen from having to pay that money?
Yes.
And so we look for other ways of funding that. But then the catch with all this is, at the end of the day, it's not just about allocating funds, but if you go to your local health center dispensary, will you get the healthcare services you want? Will you get to see the health personnel that you need to see? All the tests that you want, will you get them? So it has to be done together, but not in silos. So when you're looking at the budget that you're putting on health, you're also looking at service delivery. So they have to go hand in hand.
Yeah.
So it's, the conversations now are a bit more complex than just allocating budget. We may still allocate budget, but we still have to pay out of pocket.
Mm-hmm.
That will not be universal health coverage.
Yeah. The thing is, so what you're saying is, these are very important conversations. But looking at a business, like a journalist, I mean, like a media house, is news on healthcare, is that sexy information? Is that, will it draw in crowds? Will I get my advertisers?
Of course not. Of course not. In terms of, from a business perspective in the newsrooms, health may not be one of the things that, you know, sells the most. But what we have seen, and for me that is why I think COVID-19 has both been a crisis and an opportunity, is that it has given us an opportunity to interrogate these health issues because people are listening.
Yeah.
When we are asking, when we are talking about why as a country we were not prepared, okay, no country can be prepared, but why we did not, why we were not as prepared as country X, for example, or why our numbers are the way they are compared to somebody else, this is the time to have that conversation, because now all of these things that I'm talking about access to health, not needing to pay for healthcare services, come in play.
Mm-hmm.
Take, for example, in an ideal situation where we had universal health coverage in the country, you can access health services anywhere you want without needing to pay. We wouldn't have had conversations about that NHIF, the National Health Hospital Insurance, cannot pay for you.
Mm.
In hospitals, we wouldn't have had conversations about, you know, that if you need to do a COVID test, you need to pay for yourself. And here we are talking about 10,000 shillings, $100 plus. How many Kenyans can afford that?
Not many.
Because now what that did, just that you need me to pay to know my status and I don't have that money, I'll not test. If I have the virus, I'll continue doing my everyday business because I need to make that money. What will happen is that I will have spread the virus amongst my contacts and the spread will continue and continue. So we'll not be able to, you know, cushion, or we'll not be able to contain the virus. So the conversation is, if our health systems were better than the pandemic founders, would have been at a much, much better place.
Yeah.
And we've seen that in countries where the health systems are robust.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm actually just curious, while, is there any African country that has actually gotten this crisis right?
Rwanda did.
Rwanda did.
I remember even the Director General WHO commending Rwanda because people were not paying for their own COVID tests.
Wow.
So government was able to pay, so you could volunteer yourself to get tested. Then once you know who has the virus, you're able to do contact tracing, you're able to contain the virus.
Oh.
So you're able to limit and control and contain your numbers much better than here. Because much... We may not want to really acknowledge this, but money or the need to pay out of pocket is one of the biggest barriers to people accessing help.
Mm.
And it's not just in COVID. We encourage people to do early screening and early testing for cancer, for example. If you don't have the money to do that, if you're not feeling unwell, you will not bother to do that. So by the time you're coming to hospital is when you have symptoms. By the time you have symptoms of cancer, it's advanced, and that is too late.
Yeah.
Just because people do not have the money, or they don't have the capacity to pay for these services.
Yeah, yeah. If we can transition now to conversation around really the transition you made from being a healthcare professional to journalist, how was that transition for you in terms of even gaining the respect of people who've been there for years, and suddenly there's this girl who's come in and she's a journalist, but she was a doctor.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that like, and what has the journey been from a skills standpoint, like picking up the new skill, just being respected as someone who can actually deliver?
Until now, I still get people who don't believe I'm a journalist. because they're like, no, you're a doctor, once a doctor, always a doctor. So what are you doing in the newsroom? So are you in practice? Where's your clinic? So I still get those questions, because I think in an African society, I mean, if you are a doctor, why else would you change to anything else?
Yeah.
So I still get those questions. Even my mother herself does not. I think she's always waiting and asking me, like, when will you go back to hospital?
Mm.
So they still, you know, I'm still going through this journey with many people. I must say that I got... And could be because of the title and how the African society holds journalists. But I got a lot of respect and support when I got into the newsroom. There was a lot of curiosity, obviously, at first. Some people thought that maybe I was going through some midlife crisis or something, because how do you leave hospital to come into journalism? So I still got that. But by and large, I had good support. And I remember my biggest support at the time, because not many people really understood what it was all about, was Joe Agueo, who took me up into the newsroom. And so there was a lot of support in terms of any time I would do a story, I remember when I report early in the morning, then he'd be like, Daktari, come to my office. Then I'd go to the office, I would know it's my story. Then his first question would be, so that story you did yesterday, what do you think about it? So critique your story. Yeah. So it was always positive criticism. Then after that, you know, he would say, you know, you need to do A, B, C, and D. Do you think if you had done this and this, it would have made a difference? So it helped me critique my own work. It helped me think about my own work and my own execution of stories. So that for me was really a good support. And in terms of learning the skills, when I came into the newsroom, you know, I told them I will start from scratch,
right?
From internship, because really, I the only things I knew to do were surgeries, make diagnoses, treat kids and adults. So here, I need to learn how to script. I need to learn how to do, you know, interviews and things like that. So I started really from internship for 3 months in the newsroom. Shadowing another reporter to learn the ropes. And I remember, and I used to do all manner of things. The first time I went to the field, there was Justice Tonui. There was some case that was going on. He was in the Supreme Court, right?
Right.
Yeah, I remember. So I used to do all manner of things. There was one event I went to cover Chief Justice Mutunga, I don't know, unveiling a statue or something like that. So I used to do all manner of stories just to learn what to do, how the newsroom operates, and just to learn those ropes. So for me, and I chose that because I figured if I'm going to be good at this, I'd better learn from the very basics, so that I can build up on that. I can't start from top, and then I'll just crash. It's what you're saying. If you look at a curve like this, if you do a steep curve, the crash will be much heavier.
It'll be heavy.
But if you do stepwise, the gradient will be much smoother, and you'll be able to learn and create a better foundation.
That's so profound. I think I have many questions, Daktari, but I think what I'm hearing, and for the sake of our audience, if you're looking to retool and are looking to transition in a big way, as you did, the humility is to go back to the beginning and learn. And I think this is what we keep talking about the future. You will need to be humble and understand that you do not know.
Yes.
Yeah. And just the fact that you found a mentor, someone who had gone before you to teach you the ropes.
Yeah.
I think that's another very interesting point. Just finding the right people to mentor you, because you're going into a new space. You need to have the right people around you. Whatever career it is you're jumping into, you really do need to find a community of people around you. And
I would quickly add, the third one for me is not to be afraid to ask and not to be afraid to be wrong.
Right.
For me, one of the things I live by is that I'd rather ask and know, as opposed to going around thinking that I know and yet I don't know, because at the end of the day I would not have done any justice to myself. So even if the questions or the question you're wondering about or the thing that you're wondering about sounds stupid, just ask. Usually ask, what's the worst that can happen? You will be more knowledgeable at the end of it, and you'll be much better than you are when you didn't know. So one of the things is to not be afraid to ask and to not be afraid to be wrong.
Right. So as a doctor in our society, the world over, is a respected profession, and you haven't lost the tag. But are there times when you felt like dropping what you're doing to just go back to what you know, what you've been trained for years?
Not often. I wouldn't say, no, not often, because my day-to-day activities as a journalist still puts me in the hospital settings, still puts me in touch with colleagues. And what I like the most about what I do as a journalist is that I'm seeing the patients, quote-unquote, from the other side.
Right.
Because when, as a doctor, you see the people at their worst, as in they've been, by the time somebody's coming to you, they have something that is worrying them, that is bothering them. But now I'm able to see people on this other side before they get to the facility. So for me, where I am, I relish it, because I'm able to see the, from end to end, from when the people are the community to the point where they get to the hospital. So it's not, I wouldn't say it's every day that I miss it. There was one time when I was in West Pokot, I was in Kapenguria. I was covering a story on, what was the story on? I think it was on snake bites, on Leshkalaza, just those conditions that happen on that side. Then when we were in the hospital, there was an accident that happened, and it involved a lot of school children. So all of a sudden there was an influx of kids coming. Some are injured, some need to be attended to. I don't know, I just found myself flipping very easily and assisting to, you know, put them on drips, attend to them and things like that. So sometimes, and I think that was the one time I was like, by the way, I have missed this kind of
the
work.
The practice.
But by and large, I think I have learned to appreciate the space that I'm in at the time that I'm at that space, and to give it my very best when I'm at that space, because at the end of the day, I'll only be judged by my best.
Right.
So while I'm here as a journalist, I do my best. And one of the things that that made me decide to not practice as I do journalism was being a pioneer in this field, in this country. I figured I had better do my level best so that when other people come in, they can only better it. There'll be some precedent set, so they'll be able to, you know, juggle both journalism and the practice if they if they would want to. Because if you look at somebody like Dr. Sanjay Gupta, he still practices.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, but here it's a bit difficult. So I decided, you know, I'll give it my 100% level best. Let other people who come in now modify from where I will have left it. And it's a relay. I cannot complete it. I'll not be the best. Other people will come after me who will be better than me. And that is what I really am looking for.
This is African Retooled.
Again, amazing nuggets of advice for people looking to retool. What I'm hearing again is, look, you are the pioneer in this space in our market. That gives you an edge. And for anyone looking to retool, if you allow yourself to pick up on new skills, chances are you will stand out from the crowd. And just the ability to carry through the challenges and the having the grit to go through the tough times of learning afresh is something I'm seeing that you did very well.
Mm-hmm. I think what you've done is going to be mirrored across different professions now. Mm-hmm. And what you had said earlier, that as a journalist, what you now need to do is add value to the story. Because everyone has the story. Mm-hmm. But then there's the so what.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, it would be interesting, and maybe it's already happening, that you'd have lawyers moving into this space. You'd have pilots moving into this space. You'd engineers, have teachers, engineers.
Architects.
Moving into a space of communication. And maybe it would come to the place where you can actually practice both.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where you are actually a journalist or a communicator.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you're in your active practice in wherever you studied, mm-hmm. as it were.
It's funny you say that, Martin, because a future skill mm-hmm. that all of us are going to have is the skill of storytelling.
Yes.
Just simply because communication is going to be so vital. Mm-hmm. The ability to communicate a message clearly. And now we're even more challenged because it's communication via digital platforms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you're not able to do that, then you will struggle as a business.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you're running your practice, you need to find creative ways to communicate your service.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're right that every profession eventually will have to pick up a new skill, and the communication is actually going to be one of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so do you end up becoming a full-time journalist? Maybe some will, but generally at a baseline, communication will be very vital.
That's true. I mean, look at us. Yeah. We are recruiters, but here we are using this platform.
Yes, and having to learn about equipment and stuff. Yeah. Mic check 1, 2.
Doing all of that.
Yeah.
You bring up an interesting piece around the whole digital platforms that you are now using.
Mm.
As a journalist, what have you been able to see from a technology perspective in the health sector? Coming, whether it's looking at it from the Kenyan perspective. Actually, let's start with the Kenyan perspective
mm-hmm.
before we look at the African perspective, the Pan-African perspective. Mm-hmm. In how are we deploying technology to help us in the health sector? And of course, then we can bring that into the communication or journalism space.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is it being used effectively, efficiently, and how?
Not yet, but we are trying. Because I see, if you compare what the West is doing, what we are doing, we are always lagging behind. Mm-hmm. We always play catch up. So I know we'll get there at some point. We will. So we are employing digital tools a lot. We've seen, and you've seen major media houses going into podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing media houses on social media spaces, where we're used to the traditional news on TV, but now I don't need to actually get a TV set. I can actually watch that news on Twitter.
Yeah.
When it's streaming on Twitter, it's streaming on Facebook. So we've been able to integrate that. From the media perspective, because of the regulations and the laws that are there, I'm not really too worried about it, because by the time content is going out from a reputable media house, it has gone through certain checks and balances.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that is really not a worry. So my biggest concern is the aspect of citizen journalism, where somebody will take a video of you, Chris, and you find it online. You did not even give consent, and people are already, you know, doing stories and rounds about it. You've seen, I think there was one of our doctor colleagues, a patient was brought into the hospital. They died on arrival, was being referred, and then they were died on arrival, not a few hours after that. Somebody took the picture of the doctor, circulated it, and said, you know, this doctor killed my patient. So you see, those kind of things create an animosity, create a mistrust, and create a lot of issues with how we are, you know, running our healthcare space. They have their positive sides in that when certain bad things will happen at some point. So they have their positive sides in that when things are going wrong, then you're able to quickly bring them out. But now my fear, my worry, my concern is always how do we strike this balance when out there it is unregulated?
Yes.
Anything goes. We saw it with COVID-19 where a group of doctors came and said, we are doctors so and so, this drug works for COVID-19. And people got hydroxychloroquine poisoning because, you know, somebody was on this platform saying it works.
Yeah.
So My worry now is on that aspect, in that it's not regulated. Not everyone can, you know, decide that this is useful or this is not useful, or think about, let me confirm with my, with a doctor or a healthcare worker that I know. People don't always do that. They sometimes just take it as the gospel truth. So for me, that is the area where we need to look at, particularly in the health sector.
Very interesting. And I think, speaking about the dark side of technology, Martin, you and I, and Marcy as well, Dr. Ari, we're talking about emergence of interesting trends in the healthcare space where infotech and biotech are merging. So all of us today probably have this wrist, what do you call them?
Yeah, the fitness tracker. Fitness trackers.
And so we're able to see our vitals and even proactively take measures towards making ourselves better. Now, the problem is that with all this data being captured by a power somewhere, a government or a company, is there a likelihood that you will have these people they're calling data dictators? You know, in China, the other day, they've now released the QR code. So you're basically being advised where to go based on your health status. We have information on you, that on your vitals. We basically know everything about you. So I can take that information and use it to my benefit.
Yes.
And basically hack you, the human being. So Dr. I'm just wondering, I mean, while technology is really allowing us to make leaps and bounds in terms of the healthcare space, what do you have any concerns, and do you think that is even something we should be concerned about in Africa, because we are always behind?
No, it's not even that we are behind. They say data is the new, it's what the gold.
The new gold, yeah.
The new gold. Yeah. But if you think about it, in Africa, we've been giving our data out, where we have donors, NGOs, who and who are doing projects. They always collect our data. They always collect our data. So with this new technology where your heart rate is linked to your watch, linked to your phone, obviously there are risks to it. I don't know exactly what they would be, but obviously there is a concern. And I think even the conversation going globally is, how do we regulate this? You know, because there has to be a big brother somewhere. There has to be somebody who will watch out for this, watch out and make sure that people are not taken advantage of, particularly those of us in this side of the world, in the African continent, who unfortunately we are still very reliant and dependent on donor funding. Because I mean, if I hold the knife and the arm, I dictate, you know, what you do. So there is obviously a lot of things that need to be done in that space. But as you said, on the upside, because this same QR coding, tracking, and things like that is what really has helped China and some of those East Asian countries contain the virus very quickly. Because when you land into the airport and your passport is scanned, then they're able to know where you've come from. If you're sick along the way, they're able to know and quickly track your contacts and everything. So they're able to quickly contain the virus. So as like everything else, but technology particularly, it's a double-edged sword. So we really have to be very keen and take... focus more on the downside and make sure that the regulations and the things that are put in there are such that it safeguards privacy and it safeguards people's rights.
So Martin, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
That's true.
Don't try and come in the way of technology.
It's here to stay. You had spoken a bit about Rwanda being a beacon of hope, especially with COVID. But look at it again from the health sector and the health perspective. People like IFC have done their own studies, and the World Bank, the WHO, and they're saying there's still such a huge gap in as far as the professionals coming through in the healthcare space. And, you know, they're focusing in the next 10 years that private sector is going to invest more and more in healthcare, and so will public sector, and so will the NGOs. But again, are we training our people, and this could be from a continental perspective, are we training our people just to have the traditional doctor, the traditional nurse, the traditional community health worker coming into this economy? Or are we actually at a place where we can have conversations that see people having new skill sets, where, you know, yes, I'm studying in health, but there's a sort of emerging health and comms where you can actually come out of university being a healthcare mm-hmm. journalist, for mm-hmm. instance. Mm-hmm. So what are these, my area of curiosity is, what are these new emerging skill sets that you're seeing as a journalist, but specifically within healthcare, mm-hmm. that we need to be aware of? You know, in as much as yes, there's this gap, there's 500,000 doctors will be needed in the next 10 years. Mm. But what type of medicine are we going to be practicing in the future?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's a loaded question. And I was just quickly running through. I think I see it on two fronts, that we do not have enough healthcare professionals, the doctors, nurses, your biomedical engineers, for example, nuclear physicists and all of those people that you do not have enough, is a crisis in itself, because it means at the very basic level, you're not able to provide basic health services. Mm-hmm. So for me, if I were sitting in a place where I make decisions, that would be the place to prioritize. And the reason to prioritize this is because it takes many years to train a doctor, six years now. It takes 4 years to train a nurse. It takes, and it's full time. It's not like this other professionals where, you know, you can do part. It's always a full time job. Because I remember
people like you, Martin, part time guys.
When we were in campus, out of 52 weeks, we used to be in school 44 weeks of the year. So it's full time, it's engaging. So for me, because you cannot run away from these kind of skills, we need to invest them. Like we were saying, much as technology has improved, you still need the pilots. So you still need them trained. They still need to go and do the simulations. They still need to go, you know, and fly those small aircraft before they can advance. So you still need people at that very basic level. Mm-hmm. Then now, two, coming to what you are talking about, things are moving fast, and I've seen my colleagues in the healthcare space this side, and especially even from my own class, we graduated in 2011, the people have changed and retooled themselves in that they're looking at what other thing can I do in this health sector space to make a difference. So they're getting into public health, they're getting into health financing, they're getting into all these other aspects of health that are still critical. But the reason they are able to do that is because they have the basic foundation of having gone through the system as a doctor, having worked in the system, and so you're able to see this is the gap and I think this is what needs to be filled. So I think for me it's to have a mix of both. And then because if, let's say now we had crisis, the worst crisis ever, we are like reserves. You can still be called back to work. So you still have that basic workforce. So I would like to see it in two fronts. The basic training is absolutely, absolutely critical. And then now these additional skills come in to augment. And from the nurses to the doctors, clinical officers, all of those people can do that. Now, my beef with the African continent is that we do not retain the professionals. It's like we train for the West. You find many African doctors in the US and they are top doctors. You find them in the UK, they are top doctors. They are making or coming up with groundbreaking researches, groundbreaking things. They are amazing doctors in those countries. Why are we not able to retain them in the continent so that they can give back to the motherland?
It's a tough question.
This is, I wish you could have an answer to that.
I mean, it's so sad even now. There's no vaccine coming out of Congo or Kenya.
You know?
And so the question is, should we then also, the worst thing is that we might train them, but Canada is awake and they'll just take them out of the market.
Exactly.
It's a tough question.
Yeah, so we need to retain professionals. And I think it's very easy because given a chance, even the two of you, between being well remunerated, well accommodated, good working conditions at home, or the same outside, your country, you'd prefer to stay home.
Absolutely. Yeah,
because that's where your family is, that's where you've grown up,
Nyamachoma is here.
Yeah.
Ugali.
So people would prefer to stay home.
Yeah.
But it's because of now all of these things that we see the health professionals agitating for, not just in Kenya alone, but across the continent, where they want better working conditions. I mean, one of the things that broke my heart as a doctor, two things actually, and I think that was also part of the turning point, was when I was in one of the public facilities in the country, and there was an old man who came. He had high blood sugars, and I did not have insulin to give him. And all I just needed was like a vial of insulin, put him on a drip, and then just observe. I did not have insulin for that guy. And I had to refer him to another place 30 minutes away just because of insulin. The other one, luckily he lived. The other one was, this one always is, when I think about it, I always wonder if I could have done any different or any better. So I had a 28-year-old girl. And by the way, these things, they never leave your mind. Like when I talk about it, I can actually see myself in the ward. So she was really, really sick. She had TB. It had really compromised her lungs. And she was fully on oxygen. So she got to a point where I needed her to be in an ICU, to be under a ventilator, good monitoring, you know, all of those things. But where I was, a level 4 facility, did not have an ICU. So first of all, so I needed to transfer her. And then we had an ambulance. But this ambulance just had a bed, a driver, and a clinical officer.
Did you have fuel?
Yes, it did have fuel. It did have fuel. But now the thing is, this girl is dependent on oxygen. I do not have oxygen in cylinders. So there's what we call an oxygen concentrator. It uses electricity. So you have to power it in an electricity so that it can generate oxygen. So that is what she was on. She actually needed better oxygen than that.
Right.
So I was caught in between. If I remove her from the oxygen, she'll die. If we chance and put her on the ambulance to rush her to the next facility, she'll die.
My goodness.
Yeah, and I was very, very upset, and I'm still very heartbroken by that, because the governor at the time had done all these media campaigns about how he has state-of-the-art ambulances in the county. Yet, for me, that was just a transport vehicle. So some of these things, as a health professional, going back to the point, they break your heart. How many deaths will you certify because the system is not supporting you? These things, they weigh heavy on your conscience, they weigh heavy on you. That was 7 years back. No, 6 years back. It is still with me. I still remember the girl. I still remember her mother. Just because we do not get our things right. So some of these things, they weigh heavy on you. And that's why you see that if I have an opportunity to work at a place where I don't have to go through this, then I will actually definitely just go.
Yeah,
because at the end of the day, we are human.
Yeah.
No one goes to work to certify or to see somebody die. You actually want them to get better. You actually want them to go home and be productive members of society.
Yeah. And that's why you were saying earlier that it's really not about the percentage that you are allocating, but how we're using that money.
Exactly.
So we could have this 15%, great.
Yeah,
but how we are using it? Are we buying transport vehicles, or are we buying ambulances?
Exactly.
So I mean that's sad. But what
are there? Sorry are for there breaking some, your heart.
it's just such a sad story, and it really is a depiction of what's happening across our continent. The statistics are showing that our healthcare systems are the worst in the world.
Sadly.
In sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
That's really just
and,
so sad.
And that's why the prediction was that, you know, we will be dropping like flies because of COVID-19.
Yeah.
And we knew that our health systems will not
support this.
Be able to support us.
Yeah.
But incidentally, what has kept that from coming to pass?
We thank God, first of all, that it has
it's all our juju. And the bitter vegetables we eat. Uh-huh.
But the theories around it is that Africa has a younger population. Mm-hmm. And from how COVID has been affecting populations, it's been affecting people of a certain generation, people who are much older. And people who are much older are likely to have other pre-existing conditions, diabetes, mm-hmm. hypertension, yeah. cancer. So if you're young, if your generation is younger, they are least likely to have these other pre-existing conditions.
Yeah.
So that's why, and it's just a theory still, mm-hmm. but it makes sense mm-hmm. that even when we look at our data, 90% of people have not had any symptoms. Mm-hmm. You could have had COVID, and you only know if you test, but otherwise you do not have any mm-hmm. symptoms.
The other stupid theory is our nose is aligned with the dust.
I've not heard of that one.
Some noses are more equal than others.
Some are. Anyway, so I think, look, we're really excited to have spoken to you, and we really are happy to have shared your story with our listeners. We're hoping that they've learned something. Perhaps my last question to you: so if we do get Sputnik, the Russian vaccine, are you going to take it?
I'm yet to look at the data around the Sputnik vaccine. Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm a scientist first.
Yes.
So I'm very evidence-based.
Right.
I need to see the data. Even the Pfizer, the Moderna, yeah. who else? The AstraZeneca.
Yes.
They've just released preliminary data.
Right.
Nobody has given us, you know, let's see what is behind that so that we're able to, you know, interrogate and see.
Yeah.
But for me, the comfort is by the time it is coming to us, they would have released that information, and so we'd be able to make, an informed decision. And I have been asked, coincidentally, I've been asked this question again. If the data is convincing for me, I would take it.
Yeah.
And I would probably do it like what I did with the
on TV
testing,
awesome.
Just to
see the effects.
Yeah, then monitor for myself for the next 1 year.
Like a month, if I'm doing okay, you'll go and do the vaccine.
I mean, the sad thing, and again, to Martin, to your point earlier, when we were talking and preparing for this episode, corruption.
Yes.
I mean, it'll be shipped and packaged in some nice container and it'll land in Kenya.
Uh-huh.
We just don't know how it will be diverted and what's going to be done to it. So it's just a bit scary as well.
That would be very unfortunate.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, in Kenya, anything goes, because who ever thought that people would make away with money for a pandemic?
Can you imagine?
Who ever thought? Like, it's a crisis. It's an emergency.
Mm. Yeah.
And here it is.
Yeah.
So hopefully they will not do that for the vaccine, so that you start seeing them being sold somewhere in some places. Hopefully not, because you know that is the fastest way of getting herd immunity and safeguarding the community.
Absolutely. Mm.
You know, funny enough, I think this is a human issue because I was talking to a friend from a Western country,
right?
We shall not mention at this point.
You're so popular.
Yes, and they were saying that. The funny thing is, they had a whole consignment of PPE that they manufactured locally, that they then shipped out to another country and had it re-imported.
What?
So that some few people can line their pockets. I was like, wow.
In a Western country. Wow.
And then they didn't import the whole thing. They wrote a consignment of 20 containers, and that was what was paid for by the coffers, the public coffers. But what landed was 10 containers. And they use military vessels to.
You mean Western Kenya or Western the world?
Friend.
So Western the world. What a society degenerated.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
In this
you
time.
Know? Yeah. It's
at
horrible.
This time, uh-huh. you would think people would forget, you know, their greed and put lives first, but clearly not. Mm. So, we hope that. Yeah. That things will be different.
Yeah.
Dr. Ria, perhaps just as we come to the end, is there anything that that comes to mind that you would like to tell people looking to transition, to retool themselves, as a last word of advice to them?
I don't know if this would be advice, but it's one of the things that I live by, that I engage myself, I put myself to do things that I enjoy doing, things that I like doing. Mm-hmm. And the reason for this is when I wake up in the morning to go to work, I don't like to feel like I'm doing a duty, but I like to feel like I'm actually adding value to society. So if, for me, it's for people to just look at what are the things that you enjoy doing and create a career out of that.
Wow.
Put yourself, because if you put yourself to doing things that other people have told you to do, then you'll just get stressed. And now we're talking about mental health, mental wellness. Uh-huh. That is one of the fastest way to actually degenerate and go down. Because you'll be wondering why other people are progressing, your peers, and you're not. Yet you have your skills mismatched.
Your skills mismatched.
The other thing is for, as we said earlier, for people to take time, learn who you are, learn what your strengths are, learn what your weaknesses are, so that you maximize on your strengths. You can only be the best version of your better you. So, but if you are showing us the bad side or your weaknesses, all of us have positives and negatives. But if you're only seeing the negatives, you'll think that, you know, things are bad. But if you know who you are, what your personality is, and you match that with your career path, then you will live a fulfilled life. And at the end of the day, I think for all of us, we should strive to live a fulfilled life. Money will come in later. Okay, that's what I always keep telling myself. Money will come in later. But for now,
it's coming, it's coming.
For now, I want to live a fulfilling life.
Yes.
I want to, even if I exit today, I want to have left a legacy that, you know, I made people's lives better. Amazing. Even if it's one person.
Amazing.
Excellent. I think that's that, you know, we've come to the end of this program, but Dr. Kuril, where can people find you on social media and to get you, to catch up with your programs?
Okay. All right. On all my social media handles is Dr. Mercy Kuril. I think that's the brand name. Also, that's the other thing about retooling. Have a brand.
Wow.
You cannot be Mercy something here. Then, so my brand is Dr. Mercy Kuril on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. I'm not on Facebook much, but it's the same. On
Snapchat, TikTok.
No, that's my sister is still teaching me about these things. I'm still learning.
Yeah. All right. It's a pleasure talking to you, and we really, really enjoyed that conversation. Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure being here.
Thank you for listening in. Go ahead now and subscribe to African Retooled on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or your favorite podcast directory. We're excited to hear from you. Send your comments and questions to africanretooled@gmail.com or reach us on Twitter and Instagram on African Retooled. Until then, keep learning, keep growing, keep retooling.